Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, February the 21st, 2013. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my two wonderful co-hosts, the Georgia Gentleman, Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
I see you've been in that bottle again.
No, sir. I got my start dates. That's why I'm happy, buddy.
He's leaving Mobile in less than 2 weeks. He's on cloud nine.
I'm doing the reunion, leaving 2 days after the reunion, stopping in Atlanta for a couple of days, and I'll be in North Carolina as of March 7th.
Good for you. I know you're glad.
Yes, sir. I'm starting 2 weeks ahead of the time I did last year, but I'm doing the same two towns I started with last year. They just flopped them, and they're doing those two towns earlier. So I will be in North Carolina. I'll be staying in Greenville, and my circus dates are March 27th through the 30th, first 2 days in Dudley, North Carolina, which is actually a suburb of Goldsboro, Goldsboro is such a small town, it must be the only suburb it has. And then Friday and Saturday we'll be in Greenville, both places the county fairgrounds, so come see us.
Well, see, you must have done a wonderful job up there last time. They sent you back to them.
Yeah, I hope so. Actually, I had pretty decent crowds there.
Good.
Both times.
That's because there ain't nothing else to do. Come on, Bobby. Come on, man.
No. I like places like that. That's why we did so well in Homeland. There was nothing to do unless you were a crocodile hunter or commercial shrimp from Institute, and there's so much oil money in Houma that everybody that had jobs retired when they got their oil money. So they looked for things to do. So I was happy, but no. Both those places are great places. Greenville is the University of East Carolina is campuses in Greenville, and Ivan Koloff lives there. So. A thriving metropolis.
Shoot him out of the cannon while you're there.
No, his knees are worse than yours.
I think they got poor Ivan can barely walk.
But hopefully, I'll leave here on the 5th. I can't wait. In fact, I might pack this weekend. Just to make sure I'm ahead of the game. Oh, man. But anyway, what's been going on in Georgia this week?
Had some cold weather, wet weather.
Yeah, y'all get any snow, Bobby? Here tonight.
Bobby, y'all get any snow?
No. None. Just it's been pretty today. Been mid low 60s. Sunshine all day. Rain's supposed to start tonight.
Rain for the next 2 days. It was nice this weekend while we were up there, and so everything was great. Had a little bit of a scare, and I had special requests from Bill Bowman to let anybody who has talked to Charlie Smith or otherwise heard. Bill is doing fine. He's doing great. He went to the VA yesterday, was checked out, went to his cardiologist today, and everything seems to be okay. I guess you would classify it as a heart attack. I really wouldn't think it was, but he just.
Some people will do anything to keep from going to church. But that was a little extreme.
Yes, it was. And it scared Roberto Soto out of death.
Oh, I know
after
it
we,
did.
After we figured out he wasn't ribbing us, because that's what we first thought. We laughed at him when he first did it. But when we figured out that he wasn't ribbing us, we got a little nervous. But otherwise, he's doing great. What happened, Jerry, is I picked Bill up last Saturday morning at 8:30, and we then went over and picked up Roberto, and we headed up to Douglasville, where we were staying for the overnight for the Villa Rica show. And we had just gotten registered, gotten our rooms about 3:30. I had called Bobby, and he was already at the school or was pulling into the school, so we decided to head on over there. So we did, basically dropped our stuff and went on over to the school. And by the time the show was over and we all went out to eat, we got back to the hotel about midnight, 12:15, something like that. And we're standing there, and I noticed Bill's breathing is kind of labored, and I figured, well, he's just been off his oxygen because he has to sleep with oxygen. And I thought, you know, we'll get him on up to the room, get him hooked up, and we'll be good to go. We're standing there waiting on the elevator, and he grabs his chest and hollers, "Hey!" Well, there's nobody there. I mean, there's a fairly heavy-set lady on the computer in the lobby of the hotel, the girl behind the desk, and the three of us. So Roberto and I figured he's just ripping because, you know, Bill had been known to do stuff like that before. So we figured he was just ripping it. And then it hit him a second time. And what happened, his pacemaker, his oxygen level got so low, his heart stopped, and his pacemaker, the defibrillator on it, kicked in. And he said it was like sticking your finger in a light socket. And then it happened again. So we got him sat down, and we called for an ambulance, and that took forever for them to get there. And they were no hurry. They came in, moseyed in, and, you know, put him on a stretcher. And Soto's going nuts. Because when the girl behind the desk called for the ambulance, they're asking her 9 million questions. How old is Bill? What's his pulse rate? And it's like Soto says, by the time we answer those questions, they can be here. Tell them to get here and ask them. Soto, he's yelling at this poor girl on the phone. And she's doing the best she can. And then so they get there, and then they load Bill up. Roberto and I got my car and pulled behind him so we could follow him to the hospital, which is just another exit down the road, down I-20. So we're sitting there, and they're taking forever and forever and forever. And Roberto's like, "What are they doing? What are they doing?" It was like he was in the ambulance instead of Bill. I said, "I don't know. The girl was kind of cute. She may be, you know, giving Bill a massage or something." So finally she got out and got in the front and drove off, and we followed him, stopped at every red light, didn't turn the sirens on, and Soto's just, he's about to tear the carpet out of my car. He's going nuts. Because, you know, why aren't they, with their lights on, why aren't they moving, why aren't they doing this? So, anyway, we got there, got Bill into the, I guess they got him finally back in the ER about 1:15 or so. So we spent a few minutes back there with him and decided we'd just go up to because the girl said they were waiting on the doctor to get there. But by the time they got him to the ER and everything, his breathing was fine. He was fine. He was laughing and joking like always. But so we decided to wait in the waiting room. Well, by the time 4 o'clock in the morning got there, we still hadn't heard anything. I walked up the desk. I asked the lady, I said, "What's going on?" She said, "Oh, you can go back and see him." I said, "I've already seen him. I just want to know what's going on." And so she said, "I don't know. I'll let you walk back there." So I walked back there. He still hadn't seen anybody but the people doing tests. So he told us to go on back to the room. So we went back to the room and tried to get some sleep. And the sight of Roberto Soto with his silk sleeping mask on is a sight to see. But
I'm not going to go.
Bill Carter, what's that?
I'm not going to ask any questions, but go ahead.
I'll tell you something that was interesting Saturday night, Jerry. There was probably what they considered to be dignitaries or, you know, the guys that were in the business a long time ago. Thunderbolt Patterson was there, Bob Kelly, Curtis Smith, Inferno. There was 40 of us that they introduced. Out of the 40 people they introduced, when they introduced Roberto Soto, he got the biggest pop of anybody there.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
That's the first time he's been to anything public like that.
Yes, it has. That's the first time since he quit and had his surgery and everything, it's the first time he'd been anywhere.
What kind of surgery did he have?
He had neck surgery.
He had neck surgery and he's had knee surgery. But anyway, Bill called us the next morning and said they'd put him in a room. So Roberto and I went on to the church at Bobby's house and heard Bo James speak. And then just as church service was letting out, Bill called me and said they were turning him loose. So we rushed back over there and loaded him up. And we came on back.
I'll tell you something else too that you would have liked, Jerry. This was the high spot of the night. Soto hadn't been there long, and Charlie Smith's grandson came in with his girlfriend, and she's an attractive young lady, but she's a little on the heavy side, and we were looking for just this type person, so we set her up to go over and say, I walked over, and she said, "Aren't you Roberto Soto?" And he said, "Well, I might be." And she says, "Well, if you are, my mama says you might be my daddy."
No. He break and run.
he stood there for a second, and he said, "Charlie Smith put you up to that, didn't he?" We were all in the floor.
But I bet he thanked me a dozen times for bringing him up there. He said, "Why didn't you bring me last year?" I said, "I didn't know you wanted to go last year."
Oh.
So he made me promise to take him, bring him to Villa Rica every year. So anybody out there listening that thinks he might be related to Roberto Soto, he'll be in Villa Rica, Georgia every February from now on.
Getting mine.
That'll increase the gate right there.
Speaking of him, I don't know if either one of you guys ever had the pleasure of getting in the ring with him, but he never got the credit he deserved.
No. I never got to wrestling, but I refereed a million matches with him. And
he was one of the smoothest, best timing guys, most beautiful drop kick that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what Bill and Joe have always said, because they worked a program with him and Ramon Perez in here for about six, seven months when they were in here as the interns. Now, Jerry Stubbs was talking to him. When we were all standing there ringside after they'd introduced us, he said, "I got more taters from Soto," but he said, "because I always got hit, you know, from the rights, from right-handed people, so I knew how to pull my head and you know, protect myself." He said, "but with Soto being left-handed, I never knew how to do it." Soto tatered him every time he ever hit him.
Well, he was one piece of work, that kid, man. I'm telling you.
And he's still in great shape. Still looks good, you know. But
I tried to talk him into doing a run-in the other night and hitting somebody with a flying head scissors, and he wouldn't go for it.
But he had a good time, and I think Bill had a good time too. I told Roberto, I said, "This is like the Hangover, except we haven't lost anybody."
This hit me about Bowman. He wasn't in any kind of distress. He didn't want to pay for a room, so he goes to the hospital.
Well, he wasn't paying for a room anyway. I had taken care of all that. So.
Maybe he didn't know that at the time.
No, see what it was. See, they were all coming to church the next morning. And
well, that's been it too.
So he figured out how to get out of that.
We're kidding, Bill. He's listening, by the way, so we're kidding,
yeah.
Bill.
Yes. I'm glad he's well scared me to death. I called Michael at 1:30 in the morning. I laid there in the bed waiting on the phone to ring, and I'm glad it never rang.
Yeah.
So, talking about Soto, there was people at church Sunday morning having their picture made with him. I mean, it's the darnest thing I'd ever seen.
He didn't charge him, did he?
No.
Until next time.
Yeah. Autographs will go up. The price will increase.
What a worker. What a worker.
And he's standing there trying to get a date with Randy Colley's wife. Oh, man. But it was a good time. I'm glad the two of them got to go, and hopefully. I told Bill, I said, "Your family won't let you come out and play with me." But think about it. Last, I thought about it on after I dropped Bill off and was headed back. I called Bo James. I said, "It's something about Nightmare to Remember. It's last year you ended up in the hospital. This year Bill ended up in the hospital."
Well, I sure don't need to go near that place.
I heard that.
Oh man, but it was good. It was a good turnout. I haven't heard how much we raised for the Sunshine Fund, but it was a great turnout. And I'm already looking. I kind of mailed this and the Gulf Coast Reunion together now because they're usually a week or so apart, so one flowed right into the other. And I got a question for you, Bobby. I'm assuming you're driving down here next Wednesday, right?
Yes.
Well, you need to get up early and call Mr. Smith, make sure he gets up, because Ronnie called me yesterday. He's got Charlie tickets to the circus Tuesday night. Ringling Brothers are going at the Gwinnett Center.
So, okay.
I said he only lets you, you off the hook with only wanting 4 tickets and not 50. So he can scalp them in the parking lot. But anyway, I did talk to Ronnie a couple times yesterday, and he was going to his doctor today. Still doing the thing on his neck, and then I think he's going to Wilmington. He'll probably start around the same time I do. So look out, North Carolina, because Dundee's going there too. So he's going to North Carolina too. So if you guys hear any rumbling out of the state of North Carolina sometime in March, you'll know why. But anyway, I'm gonna take us a. You know what? I'm not even going to take a break tonight. Let's just call Les. I got some bad news to pass along, but I wanted to wait until Les was on the phone because I think he may have known one of the gentlemen that we lost this week and may have known actually both of them. So let me try and get him on the phone here real quick. Because after that, after he gets on the line, we won't have to talk anymore.
That's a fact.
Well, hello. We are not available now. Please leave your name and phone number after the beep.
This is not Magic Jack. Les, Michael, give us a call. You know the call-in number.
Hey, Michael, I saw a New York number, and I didn't realize.
Oh, he's screening phone calls now.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if it's you know, I'm thinking it's one of them damn, you know, somebody trying to sell me something because I didn't recognize the number.
We are.
I was expecting some kind of circus clown music or something.
Oh, man.
That's what I was looking for.
How are you doing this evening?
Huh?
How are you doing this evening? You sound
not bad for an old guy. How about you guys?
We're doing wonderful. We're doing wonderful.
Well, I haven't hit wonderful yet. I'm working on it, though.
I had some bad news to share, but I wanted to wait till you got on the line because we lost a couple of our colleagues this week. And I know one of them you may have known. I'm sure you were around him, but you may not remember him because he did jobs on for Fuller and in Georgia and everywhere else. A guy by the name of Bob Owen. You remember him?
Bob Owens. Yeah, I do remember him, yeah.
He and his brother Len both used to do jobs, and that's how I knew him. Was they used to do jobs on TBS. But first time I ever saw Bob, he was down here in Mobile for Fuller for a couple of weeks as a referee.
Right.
He stood out because he didn't wear the striped shirt. He wore the light blue short sleeve dress shirt with the bow tie, like they did in New York. So,
like the old referees.
Right.
Like in Jerry Oates' time, right?
Yeah, way back. Me and Hackenschmidt were hooking it up.
until I see Oates show up Mobile, I'm going to pick on him. I don't give a damn.
Somebody said you should go swing through here and get me.
Somebody asked me, said, well, why doesn't Jerry come to Mobile? And I said, well, that four-wheel dune buggy won't make it. It's just... the state highway patrol in Georgia arrested him running down interstate with that thing.
But I got to thinking about it. I think, really, who cares about seeing Jerry Oates in Mobile? I mean, really.
I do.
You want me to put on another bodybuilding show? I know what that's about.
Well, I know. No, I don't have a body to build anymore. But I just,
you know your role.
Yeah, I know my role. Yeah, know your role, right? Okay. Okay, Rock, I know my role. Who else passed away?
Danny Williams, who was the voice of Leroy McGurk's TV for 20 years.
Danny Williams.
Yeah, up until his famous line was, "Watch out for flying chairs." You never
okay, I don't remember. I never met him, and actually the name's not familiar with me.
And I think, Jerry, he was gone by the time you were out there.
Yeah, yeah, that didn't ring a bell with me at all.
But yeah, he was there. He was a well-known radio personality there in Oklahoma as well, in Tulsa. He was the voice of championship wrestling in Oklahoma from the 50s through, I think, about 1972 is when he quit.
Right.
I think that maybe about when Boyd, I don't know when Boyd, did Boyd Pierce do TV there? Jerry, when you were...
Well, we did
there?
TV in Shreveport.
Okay, so yeah, Boyd was probably...
Pierce was the guy with the goofy coats, right?
Yeah,
the wild
coat. He owned a clothing store, so that's where he got all
the... Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Les,
I know somebody seeing some old pictures of me in the 70s talking about the shirts and the jackets. I said, if you want to see something crazy, you should have seen Boyd Pierce.
I mean,
he dressed to impress, or at least to stand out in the crowd. I don't know if it was impressed anybody.
Did you ever work Oklahoma Left?
No, I never did. I tried not to, Jerry.
You were a smart man.
Well, I never blew the connection. Renesto wanted me to come out when he was booking out there one point, and I was working someplace. I don't remember where I was at the time. But I had an offer a couple times, and I was involved somewhere. So it was like I said, well, gee, I'm doing real well here, and maybe after I get done here. The funny thing is, from Cincinnati to Mobile is about between 7 and 7:50, right? And the first time Alice and I made the drive from here, we got down around just south of Birmingham, and I said, this trip is exactly why I never went to Oklahoma.
Well, you know what? Did you know on Mondays, we lived in Shreveport, go to Tulsa and back, that was 700.
Yeah.
First, start the week off. But you know what? I actually enjoyed that territory. I really did.
Well, you love to travel, I know. It's just...
Well, but I really did. We had a great crew,
Yeah. Now, you worked the Kansas City territory. I'll tell you, what I did, we did 1 week in Kansas City between Friday. Kirby and I worked St. Joe on Friday.
All right.
Drove to Minneapolis to do Vern's TV on Saturday. Then went to Waterloo to work Sunday TV. Went back to Minneapolis because they had two TVs at the time. Worked that on Monday. Came into, where the hell did, then we drove, we left out of there and came back, and I went to Dodge City, came back to KC, and went to Hastings for Joe Dusick. And that was my week.
And you talk about Oklahoma territory.
Well, it was only 1 week, because if I'd have had that every week, I wouldn't have been there for
how far was it from Kansas City to Minneapolis?
Christ, I don't remember. I honestly don't. It was a good run. It was a good run. But, a lot of the Minneapolis guys, Dusick, Omaha, and Hastings TV, Vern used to send a lot of his AWA guys in there for Joe. I mean, guys came out of Kansas City, but, Vern had guys in there, too. So I don't know what kind of drive it was over there to Nebraska from Minneapolis. But, I know... I'm trying to think of some names I can't right off the top of my head because I work in Omaha for Joe a couple times. There were some guys, out of Minneapolis territory that worked there.
Well, they were kind of
But
partnership there for, because I know Reggie Parks worked out there. I mean, Dusik had his own crew, but he recognized Vern's champions for the most part.
And he had that was one of the best.
Yeah.
Joe Dusik was one of the best payoff guys in the business.
Really?
I mean, really. Yeah. Yeah, he was a real good payoff guy. And you remember payoffs. You used to get some. Sometimes you didn't.
Exactly.
What's the payoff?
We were talking about guys
that are real thick, and you open them up, and they got 25 ones in there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. That. But they spent. Of course, back then, two of them ones that had got you 8 gallons of gasoline.
Yes.
Right. Now two of those ones won't even get you 1 gallon again.
Oh, sure won't.
You know, we were talking about guys passing away.
This ain't got nothing to do with nothing, but what's gas running around Cincinnati?
I think up here at Thornton's, I saw today 373.
That's about the same thing it is. It's 377 around Atlanta right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was 373.
Jeez.
Something like that. It you know, they dropped it down. We were down at 299 there while the president was trying to get elected.
Uh-huh.
And then after he got elected and figured, boys, I'm going to burn your asses for the next 4 years. Let's run them prices up so I can make some money on my oil stock, right? Of course, I'd figure every congressman and every senator's got good oil stock anyway.
That's
so
how it works. That's how it works.
Well, I'm just working for the government anyway. Hell, I don't care. I haven't talked to any of you guys, but since this happened. But we're talking about people passing away. Biggest shock in my life was Brad Armstrong.
Yes. Yeah.
That was just. I mean, talk about unexpected. For goodness sakes. Anyway.
That was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was. I mean, 51 years old, and in the kind of shape he was in.
Yeah.
And.
I talked to Bob Saturday night, and he told me that part of Brad's problem was he had an enlarged heart.
Is that what it was?
They said that the heart is supposed to be 2 point something if it's normal or within a certain range, and Brad's was 6 point something.
Wow.
So he said that was part of it.
And he's had that most of, I mean, he's obviously had that all his life, right? And it's just never affected him till now.
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you figure all the years he lifted weights and wrestled in the ring and put strain on that heart, and it still lasted that long, is kind of amazing in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, so, yeah. The big Bob Kelly extravaganza on Saturday night in Theodore,
yes, sir.
Huh?
Yes, sir.
Right, everybody, the whole population of Theodore and Mobile is going to be there, what I read. I don't know.
We're hoping so.
Just the guys showing up, and then the race car drivers will fill the building, for Christ's sake. It's one of those things where the guys used to say, listen, if there's a riot, some of the guys need to side with the audience. It was that small, right?
I hope we pack them out. I hope we pack them out.
Jerry, when are you coming back to Mobile? Seriously, now.
Well, I don't know. I burn up all of my sick time and vacation time.
Doing what?
Had double knee replacement.
Oh, that's right. You had both your knees replaced. That's right. Is you doing all right with that?
Wonderful, man. Doing unbelievable.
It's a good thing you had them both done at once, or you'd have never had the second one done.
Yeah, that was the only way I was going to do it.
Yeah,
that's the only way I was going to do it.
You talk about resilient. I've got a sister-in-law that's like a year and a half older than I am, and in the last 14 months, she's had shoulder surgery, a hip replaced, and 3 aneurysms.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, no. The surgeon said of the aneurysms that, you know, that she by rights should have never survived it, but they did the surgery, and they're amazed at the way she's rehabbing. Talk about resilient, for goodness sake.
Oh, man.
That's amazing. So what are we doing about wrestling, guys? I mean, what's the topic for the evening?
Well,
you know how you got to carry me.
Well, exactly. I got a half a page of things to talk about Knoxville that people want to know about. But before we get
let me mention the project I'm working on now currently, and I won't run the names of all the wrestlers down because you guys don't follow a lot of the indies. And anyway, we're running a tournament in California. The first round, it's a year long. Anybody listening, or you three guys can do it too, go to WrestlingCares.com. Each show, there's tournament runs year long. Each show, part of the net goes to a different charity on each show, the reason for the name of it being Wrestling Cares. At the end of the tournament, the winner will get a ring, no trophy or no belt. And we're using probably, it's 32 guys, starting with 32 guys, bracket A and a bracket B. And we're running a show every 2 months starting in April. And some of the best indie guys in the country. So I'm excited. And we're going to do 10-minute matches. And if you score a pinfall or submission, you get a point at the end of the 10 minutes. This is in the preliminary rounds. At the end of the 10 minutes, whoever's got the most points advance the next round. At the end of 10, if neither guy has any points or if they're tied 1-1 or 2-2, whatever, you get a 3-minute overtime and sudden death, whoever scores the first fall in the overtime. If nobody scores a fall in the overtime, then both guys are eliminated, and there's an alternate that moves into that slot in the next round. But the thing of it is, we're really going to try to have a legitimate alternative. I mean, we're going to push these guys to feature more, you know, nice switches and tell a story. You know,
they're going to wrestle? That's what
yeah. Well, about. Yeah. That's the thought. I don't want to see 30 dives through the ropes, or I don't want to see the referee count to 175 while they're out on the floor. You know what I said, Jerry, to somebody, a kid the other day? I said, you know, I watched some of these matches, and I think back when we were working, there were no security rails. Some of these guys couldn't have worked a match.
Oh, I know that's right.
You know, all those things make a lot of noise. We'll bounce off those suckers 457 times. Okay.
What's your talent look like? Do they look like athletes?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know me. I wouldn't. Well, now a couple of the guys are from down in that part of the country. And Mike and Bobby would know Kyle Matthews is going to be on in the tournament. Vordell Walker is in the tournament. Steve Anthony from over Louisiana, who's a hell of a hand, he's going to be in the tournament. So some of the guys from the Southeast are going to be involved in this thing. Micah Taylor. And, so we're excited about it.
Is it too late to get Jerry Oates in this tournament?
Well, no, not really.
And does the winner get a Cadillac like the Fuller tournaments used to do?
Of course, you'll have to travel. Sure, we have a Cadillac. Listen, if you guys want to legitimately see a good current match, go on YouTube and find Carl Anderson against Tanahashi for the New Japan title. It was on their iPay-per-view a couple weeks ago. His real name's Chad Allegra. He's from Asheville, North Carolina. He started with me, and he lives over here now. So everybody was raving about it, and I finally looked at it. And, boys, it's a wrestling match. The little detail things that drives us, Jerry and I, crazy, I know, that, like, Tanahashi started working on his right knee, early in the match, and they went over 30 minutes, I'm pretty sure. And Carl is selling that knee through the whole damn thing. And even after the match is over, he's favoring a knee on his way to the dressing room. You know, the little stuff that makes it work,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Makes a lot
exactly.
of sense.
Yeah, and their pacing was nice, you know, where you could they built the story. I'll tell you what was really, really wild. He and I had lunch a few weeks before he went over, and he said, you know, there was really no build to this title match. He said, I'm not sure how well it'll do. And he said, but I'm really glad to get it. He had just renewed his contract with them. And anyway, their building's 5,000, seats 5,000. They sold the building out, turned 1,000 away, and I think they did 90,000 buys in Japan on their pay-per-view. But the cool thing was, when the match started, the fans weren't, you know, well, Jerry, you know the Japanese fans, you know, it's just, I mean, they were just kind of there watching, right? But I think it was more they weren't sure since there was a big bill for this title match, you know, they weren't sure what it was going to be. But what really got the hair on the back of my neck standing up was, like, toward the end, that entire building was chanting Anderson. I mean, they, you know, he and Tanahashi had convinced him that he was might be just taking this damn title. And so, you know, they had done what we expect to be done, is reach out and touch those fans emotionally, not just give them a highlight reel and high spots, right?
Right.
But watch it if you get a chance. You'll really like it. I think all three of you will.
And what part of California?
We're in L.A. The first show is going to be at the Alexandria Ballroom. It's in downtown L.A. But we picked 32 guys that are, you know, that can all work. That's the main thing. I mean, you know, and so we're not that there won't be high spots or anything, but you know, like we're just talking about the Japanese match. You want them to tell a story and bring the people along emotionally, you know, and get them involved. And not turn around, stomp your foot, and clap your hands. Say, would you please support me? I'm a babyface. I don't know actually how to work, but if you'll cheer a lot, I'll take a lot of goofy bumps. Okay. Okay, good. Oh, I know. I'm sarcastic. What can I tell you?
Oh, you're preaching to the choir here, as I tell people.
Go ahead and throw my name.
I know.
Throw my name.
But anyway, what I wanted to start with, the last time you were on with us, we talked a lot about your time in Mobile and your time in Tennessee and your time in Georgia and everything, but we didn't really touch on your time in San Jose with Tony Santos. And that whole territory or promotion up there has always fascinated me, because he was based out of Boston, but he didn't run Boston. Abe Ford ran Boston for...
Well, once, actually, Abe Ford wasn't, when I went up there in 60, Abe Ford wasn't running Boston. It was Eddie Quinn out of Montreal.
Okay.
Yeah. Paul Bowser was still around there, but he wasn't promoting any at all either. So Quinn was the one that was bringing the talent into the Boston Garden. But now Santos did run, I was up there, well, for most 60 and 61, but... he did run the Boston Gardens a couple times. He would spread his wings when Pfeffer would come to town.
Right.
A lot of people didn't understand why he, bent over backwards for Pfeffer, but then I'd heard the story that Pfeffer had actually bailed him out financially at one point. So you'd see, you knew what Pfeffer was going to be in town, even if you hadn't seen him yet, because the programs would have Franz von Erich and Lou Tez and
right.
Bummy Rogers and say, okay, Jack's coming to town, right? I'll tell you a funny Jack Pfeffer story. A guy named Joe Sass, actually was my tag team partner in my second match. I played football at Boston College, and a big redheaded guy, sort of built like the Bruiser. But with real bright red hair. And anyway, Sasso, they were having a show at the old Boston Arena on St. Patal Street, and which Tony at one finally in 61 had moved his offices in there. Anyway, so Sasso was the first guy to come into the babyface dressing room. There's nobody else in there. And Pfeffer was in there curled up on a bench asleep. And the way he was dressed and with his hair, you know, and the way he looked, Sasso thought it was some bum had sneaked in the building to find a place to sleep. And Sasso threw his ass out. Because he didn't even know who the hell Jack Pfeffer was. And Pfeffer, I guess, was screaming at him, you idiot! I'm Jack Pfeffer. I can't do the Pfeffer voice and everything. But, yeah, so Joe Sasso tossed his ass out. That was, go ahead.
Pfeffer's involvement was a lot longer than I thought, because he was still around, because Roberto was talking about, you know, he started there too. Well, he started those little shows that Miguel Perez ran in the Bronx, you know,
right.
with New York's approval. But he wound up in Boston too, working for Santos. In fact, that's where he got the name. They named him Pepe Perez because knockoff of Miguel Perez.
Right.
So Pfeffer is the one that gave him that name. So he was around, I guess, another 4 or 5 years. But I think Roberto was there in 65, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Pfeffer. Now, you know, I was using my real name up there, and I was just starting out in the business. I weighed 175, 180 pounds, I guess, and just working the first, second match, and was, you know, in no significant type of programs or anything. And that was he was in and out, you know, during 1961. I never saw the man again until 1967, when Kirby and I went into Charlotte, and I would going up to the office on Moorhead Street and parked in the back, and Pfeffer had some girls in there working for Mr. Crockett. Anyway, he was coming down the steps out of the office onto the parking lot, and at this point now I had gained price. I'd put on 30 pounds maybe, and I had my hair bleached. And before I could open my mouth, he said, "Les, m'lady, how are you?" And I thought, Jesus, I people never recognized me like that. But without me even saying a word, he knew who I was. Which, you know, I thought, wow, you know, he's a little sharper than everybody gives him credit for, I guess. Boston Territory, we had a lot of fun. We Westland Avenue, there was now it's a big a multi-million dollar condo. I can drive by and say, I used to live there, man. It was, but it was, you know, it was old brownstone and four floors. And as you came into the main lobby and then each side, there were three single rooms on each side and a shared and a bath. And then at the end of each hall was like a mini apartment with like a living room, bedroom, and a kitchen. But everybody on each side shared a bath. And at one point in there, there was me, Don Kindred, who was Black Magic, Pat Patterson, Ronnie Dupre, Alex Medina, Terry Garvin, guy named Jimmy Thomas from Cleveland, Ohio, Dancing Flash Thomas was his name, Johnny Mann. And as you know, most of these guys are past now. I know Patterson and I were talking about this a number of years ago, that we may be the last of the Ronnie Garvin came in after we had left there, so I'm not counting him, but he lived in that building too. But it was just a lot of fun. You know, I was 19 years old. It was just a lot of fun. We just had a hell of a time. With some great Terry Garvin pulled some he and Patterson pulled some tremendous ribs in that building.
And was Flash Monroe around then, Gino Sanazaro?
You mean Gene Sanazaro?
Yeah.
Yes. You know what? He was one of my trainers, and at that point, Gene had never actually worked in front of a crowd, right? I mean, he'd never worked a show. His mother, you know, didn't want him to. So the crazy thing was that I worked his first house show match with him. And a referee there who was really a good guy named Ken Barbetti, he said, "We're going to pull a rib on Gene." Because Barbetti, a couple of the older guys always picked on Gene anyway. He said, he told Gene, he said, "We may get some juice tonight." And, of course, I didn't have a blade or anything. But and Barbetti said, "When I give you the sign," he said, "just take your thumbnail and run it across his forehead," right? And I did, and Gene, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. He started to panic and started slapping his forehead, looking for that blood. There wasn't any blood. But I used to go with him. His dad had like a big utility van. It wasn't, you know, like the old power company or somebody'd have, that he hauled a ring behind on the trailer. And when we go out and do shows like in Old Orchard Beach and Revere, you know, in places like that, I'd go with Gene. We'd set the ring up. We'd get in the ring and work out for, I don't know, an hour or so, go take a shower, go get something to eat, come back, watch the matches, tear the ring down, and go back to Boston. But there was a lot of good work. Medina was a hell of a worker in his prime. Ronnie Dupre was a hell of a worker. Patterson, obviously, Terry Garvin. There's a lot of good hands up there.
Yeah, but Dino worked in here. Well, he worked in here in late 50s, early 60s, and then came back in the early 70s, not long before he died. I know he was up in Charlotte quite a bit, too.
Well, that was, yeah, Gene was doing school photos or something in Cleveland or Chattanooga at one point, I think, because I know he contacted us in Knoxville about coming up there and shooting, doing some, you know, some kind of promotional thing with shooting pictures of fans, you know, fans and wrestlers and setting up a, you know, like a deal like they would in Kmart or something like that. He was talking to Ronald about that.
You talking about Alex Medina?
Alejandro Cruz Medina.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, Jerry, did you say you had work with him?
Yeah.
With Alex?
Yeah.
You ever work with him, Jerry?
Yes, you're in Georgia.
Yeah. Now, he probably wasn't a worker. When did you work with him? What year? You remember?
Oh, God. Early 70s. Early.
Okay, so he had his health problems then. When I met him in Boston, guys, in 1960, he was a bull. I mean, he had a hell of a body on him, right? I mean, he was in great shape. And talk about doing aerial stuff. I mean, truthfully, Alex was ahead of his time with some of the stuff that he did. But then when he was in Charlotte, he had something happened that just, like, they had to tap into his skull. I don't even know what it was, some kind of pressure on his brain.
Exactly.
And he physically deteriorated at that point, and it was never the same again. You know, I mean, and he just, you know, bless his heart, he was a hell of a guy. He was so much fun. He was a great guy. I'll tell you, a hell of two ribs if you're interested in hearing about a couple good ribs in Boston.
Always, always.
All right. Well, and like I say, this brownstone is four floors, right? And the main lobby, I mean, you walk in the front door, and there was marble floor and you know, a nice paneling on the walls. And at the back of that lobby was the stairway that, you know, took you upstairs to the other floors. And the mailboxes out front had long been pilfered or jimmied or ransacked or whatever. So the old man that owned this place, his name was Mr. Aston, and he had a dog named Jippy. And God, the guys used to drive him nuts. But anyway, he had a table back against the stairwell at the back of the lobby where he would lay our mail out each day after the mailman came. So Terry Garvin, we'd gone someplace, one of the laundromats, one night, a bunch of us, to do laundry. And Terry found this pink full-length nightgown, right? And it must have been a big woman because it fit him, right? So, so anyway, so Terry built this thing up, and so he lived up on the third or fourth floor, I don't remember, but he would wait and see Mr. Aston putting the mail out, and he would yell down, Mr. Aston, he said, do I have any mail? No, Terry, I'm expecting a very important letter, Mr. Aston. So Terry had written himself a letter, finally, and mailed it, you know, to the building. So anyway, the morning that he knows it's, you know, it should be there, he leans over the railing and yells, Mr. Aston, oh, yes, Terry, you've got a letter here. Now, Terry starts, oh, my God, my letter's come. And Terry's just acting Terry and starts running down the stairs. He's got on this full-length pink nightgown. He's realized he's got the bleach blonde, and he's got the hair not combed back like he'd normally wear it in 1960 or 61, but combed down, right? But this is before the Beatles, right? But combed down like that. So anyway, he hits that last run of stairwell where the table is pushed back against it, and he goes to reach over the banister as if to try to reach his letter on the table. And, of course, he can't make it. He takes the bump over the banister, onto the table, and then off the table, onto the floor, and he's got a blade. And he digs himself, right? So he's laying there selling the hell out of this and bleeding, and the old man's going crazy. He don't know what, you know, he's got this 240-pound blonde in a pink nightgown laying there bleeding in his lobby. And he's not sure what the hell to do. Do I call an ambulance or the psych ward or what exactly do I do? Oh, my God, my God, my God. And then Patterson, the other rib was, Patterson had one of those little apartments I told you about on the fourth floor. And I don't know where we came up with the idea for this, but at one point, I've lost it years ago, but I had written down, we called it the Boston Stew. Anyway, he found one of these, I don't even know who came up with the idea, but they got one of these galvanized wash tubs. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And put it on his stove. And I don't know how many pounds of oatmeal they put in there. And started and mixed it so it was thick. And then somebody decided to throw in some broke a pillow open and throw in some feathers. Then somebody thought, well, we'll throw in some orange peels. But I mean, apple rind, you know, I mean, apple core, everything. I mean, people were just dumping stuff in this thing, and it was virtually full. So we were going over, I think we were working a show that night at the Boston Arena or something. But anyway, he left the thing simmering to basically to cook the water out of it, right, on his stove on low. And we get back, and I mean, it's just like, I don't know what, you know, putty, you know. It's just, but it's so thick. But anyway, they wait till about, him and Terry wait till about 3 o'clock in the morning, when they figure the old man, everybody's in bed, right? And they carry this wash tub out to the stairwell on the fourth floor, and turn it over, and all that crap in that thing goes four floors down and hits that marble floor in the lobby, and spreads and climbs the wall. And of course, all of us, it sounded like a, you know, like a gun going off. And all of us run back to our rooms. But the next morning, we went downstairs, and it was like a science fiction something. I mean, you could see oatmeal had climbed the walls and dried, and feathers sticking out of it, and orange peel. Yeah, but that's what they did for fun. That was some of the stuff.
So you guys had to look for another place to stay, right?
No, he never knew what happened with that. He had the main apartment. As you came in the lobby, he had the whole right side of the main floor, and I guess he slept in that bedroom clear to the back, right? And so there was a door that, you know, that closed off the hallway. Plus, so he probably didn't hear that at 3 o'clock in the morning. Terry Garvin would be, we could be playing cards in Garvin's room, and just he'd get up without saying a word, walk out into the stairwell and scream at the top of his lungs and come back in and sit down and start playing cards again. And the old man would come upstairs, is everything all right? And then the dog, he'd bring the dog up with him. And what Terry liked to do is get somebody talking to the old man. He'd put the dog in his closet, right? And then the old man started looking for his dog and couldn't find the dog. Oh, they drove him. But we were paying the absorbing price. I think it was $12 a week there. So,
oh man!
But it was fun, guys. It was fun. There was, you know, I learned a lot from those guys. I really did. That was, it was just, you know, to work with those guys. You know, Medina and Goldie and Terry and Patterson. Man, I mean, it was. Of course, Pat hadn't been around much longer than me at that point. But the other guys all had 5-6 years full-time experience at that point. And Fargo and Eric Pedersen came in for Pfeffer as the Mr. Americas.
Right.
Now, I was an innocent young boy from the Midwest, and since I had a good car, Tony had me driving Pedersen and Fargo around. You can imagine what an impression they made on me, right? And if you guys probably didn't know Pedersen. But he was
tell
as crazy
about,
as.
Tell me about
he was,
him.
He placed second to Reeves in the 51 Mr. America, I think.
Yeah.
The Universe.
Yeah.
Universe, okay.
The Universe.
Whatever it was. But anyway, of course, he and Fargo both looked like, you know, tremendous. But they were crazy as hell, right? And I thought maybe you had to be crazy to be a wrestler at that point. I wasn't real sure. Or gay. I was so many gay wrestlers in the territory. I thought, boy, am I ever going to make it? I'm straight. I don't know.
Well, you know where they were before they came to Boston, don't you?
What, who, what?
Where Fargo and Patterson were before they hit Boston.
Well, they came to Boston from New York. Pfeffer had them as the Mr. Americas in New York.
Well, they were here in Mobile.
Oh, was Patterson in Mobile?
Yes.
Now, not
yes,
Greg Peterson, but Eric Patterson.
No, Eric Patterson, yes.
Oh, okay.
This was in 1960. In fact, Eric Patterson was a Gulf Coast heavyweight champion when they just up and left, both of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were about to put them in a program with the Von Brauners down here, them two as a team, as baby faces against the Von Brauners, and they didn't show. They just took off.
Wow.
And Patterson was still the champion here. At least he left the belt here anyway.
No, I never saw it, but they told me Patterson took
1972.
Yeah, they told me, I never saw it, but they told me Patterson did some of the craziest bumps in the world. They said
that's what Don Owens told me. He said
he'd fight up the bleachers and do a dead man's walk off the top of the damn bleachers.
Yeah, Don Owens told me he was crazy. He took stuff that was unbelievable for back then.
Yeah.
Jerry, didn't you say he lived in the YMCA there
in
Portland?
He lived at Sam Aprinzi's gym. He'd sleep on the
mat. I've heard so much about Aprinzi's gym. Luther Lindsay used to talk about it. That was just an old school gym, wasn't it, Jerry?
It was, but it was the most unbelievable gym I've ever been in.
Really?
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Better than Oates Gym?
Huh?
Better than Oates Gym in Columbus, Georgia?
Not that. It didn't match up to Oates Gym.
Not that good, right?
Oh, it was unbelievable. He had dumbbells. I mean, dumbbells, they would go like 55 pounds, 57 pounds, 60 pounds. I've never seen dumbbells like that in my life. I mean, he had so much equipment that he couldn't hardly work out. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And Laprinzi told me that he would come in at night after he'd been on the road out there in Oregon, and he'd get a light, hang up over him, and he'd sit there and do concentrated curls
right.
for like an hour. He said it looked like his bicep was going to come through the skin.
Wow.
And he slept on the mats, and all he wanted to do was work out, wrestle, and have a good time. But I always wanted to meet him, but I never met him.
He was a character. Of course, I was so young at the time, I don't know if I got the full benefit of meeting him or not.
Well, how did he look when you met him?
Oh, he looked tremendous. I mean, you know, back then in 60, before the juice, and to see guys, well, you know, you've seen the old pictures of Fargo when he won Mr. Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah.
You know, somebody was telling me the other day that, you know, about, well, you can't get big. Somebody asked me on a talk show about anabolics and stuff and said, you know, about Cena and Ryback. I said, look, I said, if they were ripped to the bone, if they were kind of, I wouldn't hesitate to say, yeah, they're loaded. But I said, I've seen guys get big, you know, they've got the right genetics and work right. I said, so I've been accused of things I haven't done, and I'm not going to accuse these guys because I can't really say. And then, guy, well, you know, I said, look at the clip that WWE's running now of Bruno, and check Bruno out in 1960 and tell me if he wasn't on the juice, there wasn't any damn juice, right? And those guys were talking about, when Pedersen competed with Reeves, it was just how you ate and how you trained, right?
He was rock hard, wasn't he?
Oh, he was, yes, absolutely. You know, and Jerry, that's the thing. A lot of people, you know, I was telling these guys, they asked me about this. I said, listen, I've seen guys on the sauce that didn't look like, I mean, you would, you know, you'd think I was crazy if I said those guys are on anabolics. But haven't you? I mean, guys will just take them and think, well, I'll get, and they don't eat right or don't train right, and they get watery and
exactly
puffy, yeah. Well, you know, when I don't know when D-Ball first came around, I won't mention the person's name, but one of the guys that was in a territory at the time where I was at he was 220, and he decided he had to be 240 or 245, and so he got started taking a D ball. But to me, it looked like somebody just put an air hose up his rear end, right? I mean, he was just puffy. And he said, "Don't you?" I said, "Listen, I can go to the buffet and look like that. I don't need to take drugs, right? I just go to a pitch till you win every day and eat myself into that kind of shape, for Christ's sake." But that, well, Jerry will tell you though. But back then, the guys that were, you know, were loaded like that were just big, right, Jerry?
Exactly.
I mean, they were big, but they were smooth.
Smooth.
Yeah. Except for your boy Draper.
That's right.
It's funny that you mentioned Luther Lindsay. He actually died on this date in 1972.
Really?
You know what? I was there.
Yeah, I knew you were.
Yeah. I'll never forget that as long as I live. I mean, Luther and I were tight. He traveled with me a lot. He stayed at my house or my apartment in Charlotte sometimes. But that night, I'll tell you, that night's as vivid to me right now as it was in 1972. I worked the match before him. We passed, you know, him coming to the ring, me leaving, and he said, "Give a hell, Buffy." And I said, "Yeah," but he called everybody Buffy. And I said, "Okay, but you too, Buffy." And we slapped hands or something. Anyway, I'd just come out of the shower, and an usher stuck his head in the dressing room and said, "Something's happened to Luther." He said, maybe dying or something. I forget what the guy said, but I pulled on my slacks and had flip flops, and Weaver and Abe Jacobs and I went to the ring, and they had the life squad in, and they actually brought him back briefly in the ring and put him on the gurney to take him to the hospital, and I went back and told John Ringley. I said, I'll take his stuff and go over there. So I start putting his bag together and started to finish dressing, and Ringley came in the dressing room. He said, "Les, don't rush." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Luther's gone." I was one of the pallbearers at the funeral.
What kind of guy was he, Les?
Luther was just an amazing, I mean, funny as hell, personable as hell, but cross him and he's as lethal as a rattlesnake, brother. I mean, he was just, just a hell of a guy. I mean, I loved him to death. I mean, he was funny. You know, the crazy thing was, as tough as he was, that never came about. He was a gentleman. I mean, he really was. I enjoyed his company.
I never met him.
Yeah, he was good people. He really was. You know, he was born and raised in the South. He was a black All-American before All-Americans were just, you know, All-Americans when he played at Hampton Institute. But that's the first time he ever stayed at my apartment. We were doing Wednesday night, we'd done TV in Charlotte, and it snowed while we were at the TV station. We came out, it was 3 or 4 inches of snow on the ground. In that area, that's a blizzard, man, right? And he had his farm was up north of Greensboro. And I said, "You'll never get home." I said, "Come over to the apartment and stay." So he came over, and anyway, early the next morning, it was still dark outside. Something woke me up, and I hear somebody downstairs in the kitchen. Of course, it had to be Luther. And I thought, "What the hell is he doing up this early?" Because it was like 6 a.m. or 6:30 or something like that. It was still dark. And I got up, went downstairs, and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh," I said, "you know, I got to get home." I said, "Luther, those roads aren't clear yet. Just, you know, relax, take your time. There's no big—" "Oh, no," he said. And I said, "What the hell is your hurry?" And he just looked at me. He said, "Well," he said, "I was going to get out of here before day. I didn't want your neighbors to see me." See, it was that black-white thing, right?
You're kidding.
And I said, "Listen, I pay the rent here. You stayed on midday if you want. We'll go out and a hug in front of your car before you get in. I don't give a damn, you know." I said, "Just relax." I mean, he was, I'll tell you the truth, I cried my eyes out at the funeral. I really did. He was just a hell of a guy. Amazing. Well, you know, that night he died, his heart was weak anyway. He had walking pneumonia, and they said that he had just come back too soon. But he had been in a car wreck where the doctor said had he had not been as muscular as he was, he'd have been killed, you know, because of the thickness of his chest. I mean, he was just, now there's, you know, there's a guy who was just rock solid, too. Boy, he was built like a bull.
How old was he, Les?
Oh, God, Luther was in his 40s. You know, it's funny, I had one of those little leather autograph books when I was a kid, right? And I'd go down here to Music Hall and get everybody's autographs. And Luther was one of the people that when I told him that, he said, "How much did it cost me to get you to burn that autograph?" But I mean, that was his sense of humor. He was just he'd see Bernard and Lucky Roberts and Mahler coming to dress. He said, "Here comes the three brothers, Klu, Klux, and Klan." But I'll be honest with you, Larry Hamilton. Larry came to the funeral, and I remember him saying, he said, "You know, a lot of people think I'm racist." He said, "But I respected this man." And he said, "And I'm here to pay my respects." But I think, I think anybody that got to know him really had to respect him and like him. He was just a good guy. Did I put you guys to sleep?
No, I'm just sitting here thinking, my favorite, I never met him, but my favorite Luther Lindsay story, and I know, is Bill still listening?
No, he's dropped off. Joe dropped off too. So,
him and Joe went to the funeral home the day after. Evidently Mr. Crockett had said, you know, heels go in the afternoon, baby faces go at night or something. Just don't, you know. So they said, Joe and Bill said when they got there was nobody there. And said Joe went in and he paid his respects and he was signing the books and he said he heard Bill going, "Joe, come here and count. Come here and count." And he said he turned around, went back in there, and Bowman was stretched out across the top of the casket.
What?
And Joe said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I never could beat him when he was alive." He said, "I just wanted to pin him one time."
Well, you know what? I would, you know, of course, I never saw him go. But from all accounts of everyone said, he was one of the baddest of the bad. I mean, it wasn't just that he was a hell of a wrestler, but he was just strong as a bull. Too.
Yeah,
you heard the story about him and Stu, right? In the dungeon.
No,
where Luther had a bad knee. Jerry London told the story. I guess he was down in the basement, and they were at the house, and Stu saying, "Looper, let's tussle a little bit, you know, let's work out a little bit." And Luther said, "Nah, Stu, my knees bother me and everything, you know, my knee, I'll steer clear now, you know." And Luther said, "Well, you promised to." "Oh, yeah." So anyway, Luther started on his fours, and Stu started on top. And I guess not being able to turn him, Stu got frustrated, and he dropped his knee in behind Luther's bad knee. And London said, I remember him telling the story, he said, You've heard the calm before the storm. He said it was just like there was a moment of dead silence, and he said Lindsay exploded out, turned, front face locked Stu, and drove him back against the basement wall to where his feet were off the ground. And he said he cinched up on that crossface, and Stu started giving him the office, Buffy, you know, "Let me loosen up," he said. You ever hear the story about Luther and Gordienko and the Smith brothers in Calgary?
You talking about Smith Al and brothers. John Smith?
Huh? John Smith and Al Alexander.
Yeah.
And it was they were the Canadian Open Tag Team Champions, you know, and they traveled all the territories in Canada defending their titles. And so anyway, they'd come in, they were working Calgary, and they were defended against Gordienko and Lindsay. And I guess Al Alexander, I never met him, but Luther, again, listen to Luther tell the story, is when they were introduced, Alexander said something to Gordienko. He said, "I hear you got a few medals."
you know, or a pretty good wrestler. He said, I got a few medals at the YMCA myself, you know, like kind of being a smart ass about it. Luther said, Gordienko didn't say anything, and so Luther didn't say anything about it. So when they got to the ring, Gordienko said to Luther, he said, let me start tonight. And Luther said, their thing had been like if Luther started on Monday night, Gordienko started on Tuesday, you know, and they'd alternate. And Gordienko just said, let me start tonight. I feel a little, I want to loosen up a little bit. So he started. It was John Smith the one that started. And then he tagged Alexander in, and Alexander came in, and Gordienko very quickly hooked his ass and beat him, right? Right? And Stu and Luther saying, Stu coming down you know, the aisle saying, ah, you bastard, you're killing my territory, right? Killing my territory. So, of course, it, you know, back in the day, you used to go to the dressing room between falls. So they get back in the dressing room, and Alexander's all puffed up. He's wanting to take his boots off and go home, right? Pack his bag, right? And so they, John Smith and I guess and Luther and Stu calm him down and say, oh, we're going to be all right. We're going to go out there and do this. So Luther and John Smith knew each other well and were good friends, I guess. So they said, okay, we're going to take this rib a little bit farther. So they go out for the second. Now, realize the challengers have won the first fall. So they go out for the second fall, and Luther and John Smith start, and they're working a shoot. And they said, Stu's about to have a friggin' heart attack because here his challenge is going to beat the champs, Canadian champions two straight falls. And this time, he doesn't just come down to the apron. He climbs on the apron. Looper, you bastard. You're going to kill my territory. you know, Luther knocked the hell out of two, I can't remember, I'm trying to, Tubbs, two top 10 heavyweight boxing contenders. This was in Portland. And I cannot for the life of me. One of the Supremes' brother was a fighter. Do you remember who it was?
No.
Anyway, I think it was Ernie Shaver and I forget who it was. Somebody else. Anyway, both these guys were top 10 contenders, right? For the heavyweight boxing title. And it was in a bar, and Luther gone in there minding his own business, and these guys, I guess, had had a little bit to drink, and so they started, you know, started a conversation, and it built to boxing and wrestling, and then as boxers, they wanted to, you know, belittle wrestling, and they ended up out in the street. Luther, I forget, maybe it was, I'll say Shaver because I can't think of the other guy's name, knocked one of them on his ass, threw the other one over the hood of a car, and we'll say Shaver's the one he knocked down. He took off running down the street and came back in a cop car and wanted the cops to arrest Luther.
Huh.
So that was some of the Luther Lindsay stories.
He was big out in Portland. He and Shaq Thomas were.
Yeah, yeah. Shaq was an Ohio State football player. I never met
Shaq.
Yeah,
I knew that. Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah.
He came through Mobile, you know, back in the days in the 60s where they could only, black wrestler could only work with another one, but he was using the name King Kobe. I don't remember who he worked with. It might have been Tiger Conway Sr. I don't remember who it was.
Right.
Well,
yeah, Luther.
Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say, I think I've always heard the story, and I believe it. A lot of, they, you know, how with Gotch, they wouldn't put belts on Gotch because they're afraid if he didn't want to take them off, he wouldn't.
Right.
And I think as over as Luther was in the Carolina territory, he never had a championship, and I think that's the reason. Because they figured if he decided he didn't want to drop the belt, he wasn't going to drop the belt.
You know, I saw some tape on Gotch. I was shocked. He wasn't.
You worked with Gotch?
Oh, hell no, I didn't work no gotch.
I'll tell you, I remember watching when he first came to Al Haff's territory here when I was still a fan, right? It was Carl Krauser, they called him at first, and then Carl Gotch. But, of course, once I got in the business, I knew his reputation. And then when I started working around here, I remember being in a dressing room, and I remember hearing him say he was offended by these guys with sequin jackets. So I knew if Gotch was going to be on a show I was on, I'd be sure not to take a sequin jacket.
But he was a horrible worker, Les.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah.
Horrible. Just horrible.
Yeah.
I think it was, you know, a lot of depends on who he was working, because I've got some stuff with him in Japan. He and Fez working against Inoki and Sakaguchi.
Well, I saw him work with Inoki in a single match, and he was horrible.
Well, this one's pretty. He was pretty entertaining in this one. He was a lot like Billy Robinson. He moved all those, he did all those European twitchy spin around and do that stuff. If you ever seen Billy Robinson work, he
I'm
worked.
I'm talking about just working. He couldn't take a pack. I'm telling you,
yeah,
it was horrible. I mean, you know,
you know what always amazed me is the time that he and Bill Miller got mad at Buddy Rogers.
I heard that story up in Ohio, right?
And I've heard people say, Rogers must have been chicken shit. He wouldn't. I said, are you crazy? Bill Miller stand on one side of him and Carl Gotch on the other, and they want you to stand up? You'd have to be friggin' insane to stand up. I mean, for real. I remember I worked with Bill Miller. Bill was a hell of a hand. I knew his reputation. It was in Huntington, West Virginia, first time I worked with him. And, I was still just a couple years into business. And I thought, hey, you're working with Bill Miller. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to screw up because I'd heard about his temper, right? And he came in, and they said, you're working with the kid. And he said, you're a Buckeye, too, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, well, good. He said, and he was just so nice. And he said, well, you know, there's a big difference in our size, so we need to get you over because I'm going over. And he put me over like $1 million. But I mean, just, you know, it was just tremendous to work with. I never
He's
had a
nice
problem
man. Super nice man.
He was. He did a thing here
time.
Since. Go ahead. Tell you.
No, I worked with him one time in St. Louis.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, well, he and Danny both are good, just wonderful people.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but Bill is, here in Cincinnati, Bill was working, doing the Dr. X thing, right? And, he was working with Don Leo, and I was just, you know, I was on the undercard. And so anyway, he wanted to load the mask at the end of the match and, you know, headbutt Don Leo, and wanted Don Leo to get juice to get the idea over that he had a foreign object in the mask. And Don Leo said, oh, I don't want to do that. Something to, like he had a chance for a movie role, and he didn't want to, you know, scar himself or something, you know, because he was going in a couple of days was going to get a screen test for something or other. And it kind of, you know, Bill's wanting to get this over. And he said, Les. And I said, yes, sir. He said, come here a minute. He said, I'd heard their conversation. He said, wonder if you do me a favor. And I said, sure, Bill, what's that? He said, after our match out there, he said, I want you to come out and squeal on me to the referee. And then he said, if you don't mind, he said, I'd like to give you a headbutt if you'd get a little juice. And I said, yes, sir, I'd be happy to do that. So that's how I got involved in these two big stars match, because Don Leo wouldn't get any juice, right? So.
Anything to get in a main event. That's
pretty
cool. Yeah. Well, I, yeah,
I mean,
you're right,
you know,
yeah.
He let the Infernos burn him in Charlotte, and, you know. Anything to get himself into a program, you know.
Well, I just, anything to get over. My God, yes, absolutely.
You guys were talking about Gotch. In 1973, I guess, I had the privilege of being around John Foley. And Foley,
I worked with John Foley, yeah.
Foley made no bones about it. He was one of the guys at that school over there that taught Gotch. And I would ask him, you know, I'd never met Gotch, never seen him, and I asked him, I said, well, you know, if you and him were to wrestle, and Foley, in no uncertain terms, would say, a teacher never teaches the pupil everything. And it wasn't too long after that, we were somewhere one night, and somebody didn't show up, and Ernesto goes, "You got your stuff?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Go put it on. You're going to work with Foley." Okay. But he treated me like, I mean, it was like he treated me like a newborn babe. I mean, I didn't know he was there.
Yeah, and Nelson Raw and I worked a program with him and Dutch up in Knoxville, and he was easy to work with, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't a problem at all.
Funny guy. Funny
yeah.
guy.
Yeah, he was a character, that's for sure. He liked to tip the bottle a little bit there.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Well, speaking of Knoxville, I'm going to get to this list of things that between Teddy Baker and Bo James, they give me a list of things to get you to talk about.
All right.
And the number one thing is, do you remember working with you and Whitey against the Wright brothers in the rain?
Sure. We sold the place out, for Christ's sake, outdoors in the rain. Yeah, we were the first, Whitey and I were the first baby faces over on John's when I first worked first time I worked that territory in fall of 68, they had no television. John had no television because Anna had no TV. And then when he got TV, of course, the Wrights were the first heels to get over, and Whitey and I were the first baby faces. And we had a hell of a program there. Not in the rain show, but we set the outdoor attendance at the amphitheater in Chilhowee Park. That, as far as I know, still stands. Fuller beat us money-wise, but then the ticket prices were higher in the 70s, you know, in the late 70s.
Right.
But he never outdrew us in number of people. But that the night of the rain, John, for some, you know, when Ron had the territory, if we thought it was going to rain and we were at the amphitheater, it's just a stone's throw over to the Jacobs building where we ran inside at the park, right? But Kazana
right.
would never make that designation. If it rained, John just canceled out, you know? So anyway, we were in the midst of this angle. I don't remember what it was we'd done to build for this particular match now. But anyway, we're in the dressing room, and it started to rain. And the wind is, and I don't know if any of you guys have ever been in there, but the windows in that thing are real high. There are no air conditioning, and the windows are high, obviously, so you can open it and the people can't see in. Because they had, during the fair, they had musical, you know, concerts and stuff out in the amphitheater as well. So anyway, John comes in, and he said, "My God," he said, I hate to lose this house, but he said, or hate to lose this angle, or, you know, got such good heat, but he said, with the rain and all. And Whitey had been climbed up on one of these tables and looked out the window. He said, "John, before you decide to cancel the show, you better come look." And John, a couple of us got up on the table. And there were two lines from the two box offices all the way around the boxing building and down the driveway out of sight in the rain. And he said, "Well, we're going to run." Of course, they said, you know, once you get the main event on, the advertised main event, then there's no refunds. So they put one match on ahead of us, and I took my boots off. I always, in the rain, I didn't enjoy wrestling barefooted, but with the soles on those shoes, I think Jerry will tell you it was like drag slicks on asphalt.
Yeah, you kill yourself right there.
Yeah, you slide all over the place, and I just got, you know, better footing without shoes on at all. But the rain started coming down at that angle to where if you were going to go, you couldn't look straight at your opponent. You had to cock your head, otherwise the rain would blind you. The ring lights swinging back and forth, and the people were just sitting there. And we went three falls, and they sat there through it. I mean, it was the damnedest thing. We did some tremendous business.
That's what you call being over then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, who was it used the chloroform? Oh, it was Ring of Honor used chloroform on one of their pay-per-views or iPay-per-views or something. I didn't see it. And everybody was talking about it. And I said, "Man, we did that back. We did that there. We at the TV station." You guys will remember when they first got color television, the lights had to be so hot because the cameras weren't as sophisticated as they are now. And so anyway, the angle was that Ron and Don goaded us into putting the belts up on TV. And then we get into a four-way. Donnie and I fight out onto the floor. The referee is distracted with us, and Ron pulls out the cloth of the chloroform and puts Whitey to sleep. Well, the thing was that in that closed area with the fans in that studio and in the heat, hell, everybody damn near got chloroformed, for Christ's sake. I mean, there was no doubt. I mean, if you were in that room, you knew that was real. I mean, it wasn't a work. It was a shoot, right? It was real chloroform. It couldn't have been anything else. And we drew big with that, too. I mean, it was that first, the Christmas after they first got the TV. I'll tell you, as far as babyfaces, how we were over was we got a Christmas card, as best we could tell, was signed by every member of one of the UT sororities. I mean, there must have been 50 names on that damn card. But that was kind of audiences we drew at that time. Because, of course, there hadn't been wrestling television on there for, like, I don't know, maybe never. I don't know. I don't know if anybody had ever had TV before. I think they did have TV before that, but then they lost it or something. But, that was a good run.
You ever get hit with the chisel?
Yeah. You know what? I was leery of it at first, but it wasn't bad at all. I'll tell you somebody, Ron Fuller damn near butchered Rocky Smith with it. You know, Ron without his glasses couldn't see his hand in front of his face, and
you mean Ron Wright?
No, Ron Fuller. He borrowed the chisel from Wright. And was going to use it on Rocky, just when Fuller was healing. And anyway, he hit him once, and the blood didn't come gushing. And Ron, you know, like I say, his eyesight wasn't all that good, so he didn't realize he'd bleeding. Also, he hit him again. Hell, he cut him three times before he realized. Rocky said, "That's enough. I got it." The worst Ron ever split me wasn't even with a chisel. We'd worked an angle, well, off this angle, this chloroform thing, they wouldn't give us a return match. And so we were out of there for a while, and we came back as the Avengers, all white outfits, long tight shoes, white mask. And so anyway, we drove them crazy with that. Dennis Hall was there at the same time. But, you know, once Ron's saying, You know, that's Les Thatcher and Whitey Caldwell. I know who that is, Thatcher and Caldwell. And so the next week, Hall put on the Avenger outfit and went out there with Whitey, and I came and sat ringside. And then he'd scream and holler, and then the next week, Whitey came out and sat ringside, and Hall and I, you know, worked the Avenger thing. But anyway, he hit me with a mask. I had the mask on. He hit me with a belt. And I know Whitey kept saying, "You all right?" And I said, "Yeah, well, I don't know what you're talking about." I mean, it was a potato. There was no two ways about it. I mean, I felt it. But when I got upstairs in the locker room and looked in the mirror, the whole top of that white mask was just solid red, man. I was bleeding like a stuck hog, for Christ's sake. We were working, the four of us, and the ring didn't have a skirt on it, right? So we got into a four-way, and Ron says, "Follow me out." So anyway, or throw me out and follow me. So I pitched him and went out after him, and he scooted under the ring, and he said, "Follow me." So anyway, I went in after him, and he turned around right about the middle of the ring, and we start throwing his punches. And anyway, he said, "You know, let me take over." And so anyway, he pulls this roll of adhesive tape out of his tights and starts taping my neck to one of the ring supports, right? And so he's facing me when he's doing this, and I see the look on his face is changing in his eyes. He said, and I hear him say, "Oh, Christ." I said, "What?" "Oh, shit," he said. And he starts backing out, the way we'd gone in, but he's still facing me, and he's on his hands and knees backing out to get out of there. And I'm thinking, what the hell's going on? And then just a few seconds later, in my peripheral vision, here comes one of the fans with a damn knife right under the ring. And Ron, by this time, Ron was already out. And the guy says, don't worry, Les, I'll cut you loose. And I said, don't worry, I got it, man. I thought, he'll start swinging that knife under here and cut my throat, never mind the damn tape.
Nothing like Tennessee wrestling, huh?
Boy, ain't that the truth. Ain't that the truth.
Now, were you there the night, I guess, the most legendary match in the history of that of East Tennessee, I guess, was Dory Funk Jr. against Whitey Caldwell. Were you
absolutely.
The
I was standing in the balcony, watched every minute of it. Yes, sir. That was a hell of a match. Whitey was a hell of a worker. I mean, he was. He wasn't big. And he was a tough little son of a gun, too. I mean, the guys who knew him from East Tennessee gave him a wide berth. He was probably 190 pounds, but he was rock hard. And I'll tell you, one time we had a little run-in. Whitey always said, look, he said, this is a part-time thing for me. This is Les's full-time business. So, you know, if he decides that this is a better finish than whatever, then I'm going to go with that because he makes his living at this and I don't, right? He was just really a good guy and a great guy to have as a partner. So anyway, we're finished, and I don't remember what it was, but Ron wanted to do something else, and I said, I don't think that makes any sense. We did. So anyway, we were going out there and do my finish. And so in the match, Ron is trying – and I can hear this, and of course, Whitey told Ron's trying to convince Whitey in the middle of the match to change the damn finish. And he said no, he wasn't going to do it, which pissed Ron off. So we get back to the locker room, and nobody said, no, I got undressed and went in the shower and goes, get ready to take a shower, and here comes Ron and Don, right? And they're getting in my face, and I think, okay, here we go, you know. And before anything could happen, Whitey come walking in behind, and he said, hey, if you're going to fight him, you're going to have to fight me too. And the fight was over. The odds became even, and they weren't in I don't know if I scared him at all, but he sure as hell did, right? I mean, that was, okay, it's over. And they walked out.
Were you still there when he was killed in the car wreck?
When he was what?
Oh,
no, in the car wreck, no, but I went up. Frank Morrell and I flew up with John Ringley out of Charlotte for the funeral. I'll never forget that either. They rented a plane, the same pilot and plane that used to fly the boys around. And since Frank and I had both worked with him extensively up there, and, of course, Frank being from up there, Mr. Crockett said to John Ringley, take Les and Frank with you and go up and represent us for the funeral. And so, you know, we flew up, and then they rented a car at the airport there in Johnson City. And I'll never forget, we got to the church, and it set back off the road quite a distance, you know, in a nice yard, a nice white church. And that sidewalk from the street all the way to that church was lined with people two or three deep on both sides when we went into the church. I mean that place was just jam-packed with people. Well, you know, they tell me, and I don't know, that I assume it's true, that people still go to his gravesite and put flowers on it to this day.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, he was over.
And he was only a part-time worker. Can you imagine what he'd been if he'd worked full-time?
Yeah.
Or maybe that was part of his appeal because he was, people knew he, you know, worked there and lived there and was in that part of town.
He was one of them, right? I mean,
exactly. Bo James, I wanted to know, said you never worked for Mickey Barnes much.
I don't think I ever worked for Mickey Barnes. I don't know if I even met Mickey Barnes. I know the name. I think I met him, but I don't think I ever worked for him. The only time I ever worked up in Johnson City was when Nick sent us up there. You know, Dennis Hall promoted the Tri-Cities for a while. He moved up there briefly and promoted it a while. And then when Jerry Jarrett first came in to work the territory as a promoter, when he left his real job and moved down there. His first wife's brother, they were supposed to set up and run the Tri-Cities as well, but I don't know why that never happened. But I know that I remember Jerry or somebody telling me that was the plan initially, that his brother-in-law was supposed to, I think, settle up there, but nobody ever did. I know they bled Ron when Ron bought Kazana out. I remember him telling me something about percentage. I said, percentage of what for what? He said, well, you know, I got to send them percentage for John. I said, you're out of your goddamn mind. You don't owe them nothing. I mean, you know, there were so many people that run up there.
Yeah.
But I think I met Mickey Barnes somewhere. I can't remember where. But I never worked. I don't think I ever, unless he was the local promoter when I worked up at Kingsport or Johnson City when I was working out in Nashville office. But I think he was.
Yeah, I think he was the local promoter.
That would have been 68, 69. So, but I do remember meeting him. And of course, I know the name. He's the one that started Whitey, I guess, and Ron and Tony
yeah.
Peters and a whole bunch of the guys that worked up there. Well, hell, Bo James is Bo's the historian.
Yeah.
He probably knows more about what went on there than I do.
Well, that's the reason he was asking. He was asking if there was if you guys had or Kazana had a problem with Barnes, why they seemed to send everybody up from Knoxville except you.
I don't know. I'll tell you what. The crazy thing was Nick was getting a piece of Knoxville. I mean, you know,
right.
John paid a booking fee, and we were drawn like crazy. And Nick tried to sabotage it. And when I say sabotage it, it's like, we'd be sitting down working out a finish for Friday night. We did TV there on Saturday morning. And John would say, well, gee, we could do this if Les could be on TV. I said, what do you mean if I could be on TV? I said, I thought I'm here on. Well, he said, Nick said he got you in such and such. I said, well, let's do the TV. And I'm thinking, you know, and I said something to Nick one time. I said, Nick, it makes no sense. We're drawn up there for me not to be on TV because, we go out of the house show on Friday night and do our TV Saturday morning and, continue the angle and set up for the next week. And I thought, this is crazy. Nick, it was like Nick didn't want it to draw or something. And Hall and I, one time, we did three TVs in the same Saturday. We worked Knoxville on Friday night. We did Knoxville TV Saturday morning, pulled our sweats on over our trunks and stuff, went to Chattanooga, worked Harry Thornton's TV on Saturday afternoon, pulled our sweats on and went to Birmingham, and worked Birmingham TV Saturday night, and then went home to Nashville.
Unbelievable.
All the days were.
Birmingham TV at midnight, right?
Yeah, Birmingham TV was live, whatever, after the news, whatever it was on Saturday night, 10 to 11 or 11 to 12 or some goofy thing. Well, Waterloo, Jerry, wasn't it? It was live. Was it live when you were there?
No, we didn't do TV up there.
Waterloo TV was live on Sunday night when I was in there in
63. When I was there, everything was done out of Kansas City.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing was they had the blue laws, and if you went into Waterloo on Saturday night from whatever show you worked there, you could sit in a hotel and twiddle your thumbs all day, right? I mean, there was no movies to go to.
Not really, no.
No, nothing. Yeah, the blue laws, everything was closed on Sunday. And then the TV was live that night.
You mentioned Kazana not having TV until whenever you went in there teaming with Whitey. But I've heard you tell this story before. When you went back in to do the TVs for Fuller after he bought Kazana out, and how you asked them about the formatting and everything. That's a funny story about that.
Yeah. Well, when I was in there for John, I had never done TV as a commentator or anything else, so I never paid any attention to that stuff. I didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. Didn't matter. And then when I went up there for Ron in 74, of course, I'd already been involved in television production. And that's the reason, you know, when I went in, he said, look, I don't know anything about TV. It's all yours. You got carte blanche. Short of doing something entirely crazy or stupid, make the TV what you want it to be. So the first weekend, it was first weekend in November, 1974. I flew into Knoxville Airport. He picked me up. We went to lunch, and then we went to his house. And he said, okay, we got to put TV together. I said, where's your formats? We don't have any formats. I said, what? He said, we don't have any formats. I said, you don't have? He said, they don't use a I said, Kazana never used a format. Everything was just run by the seat of their pants. And so anyway, I said, well, get me a ruler and a plain piece of paper, and I drew a format. And we went out and had some Xerox copies made at Kinko's or someplace like that and came back. And so I put the format together, and I said, you know, how much commercial time have you got? And I, you know, put the run times in and everything. So we went in. We were still at Channel 26. That was the ABC affiliate up on the hill. It's where Kazan had his TV at the time. So we went in Saturday morning, and I went in. Ron introduced me to the director, and I said, here's the format. And he looked at me like I was nuts. Format? And I said, yeah. He said, we've never used the format. I said, well, we're going to start using one now. But, yeah, they had, Kazana just did his hour by the seat of his pants. Nothing was ever timed out. They just knew they had 58 minutes and 30 seconds, and they got 58 minutes and 30 seconds.
Everything was a warp your head off hold.
Oh, God. You know what? Jim was a nice guy, but that was Ron. You know, I kind of felt bad because Jim and I got to be friends when I was, you know, when he was doing the funny thing. We did the mask, the Avenger thing. We came out, and it was meant to kind of tip the people off at the very end of the show, the first day that we were on, because John had set this up, you know, saying, why do you, you know, Ron said, well, who's, you know, John saying, well, you need to defend the tag team belts. Well, we're not defending against Caldwell and Thatcher, that's for sure. Okay, well, how about these guys? No, how about the, well, we got a new team coming into the area, the Avengers. How about, well, you know, they, I've never heard of them, so they obviously can't be too good. Yeah, we'll defend against them. And so we're on TV the next week, and we get a little win. And so at the very end of the show, we go over and sit down, one of us on either side of Jim Hess. And he's and at the very, the show's about ready, he's about ready to cue out at the end of the show. And I, you know, because I've got kind of a distinctive voice, and I had a Yankee voice in the southern area, so it was more distinctive. I said something, I forget what it was, you know, to, like to close out the segment, and Hess looked at me, and his mouth dropped open, and up to that point, he had no idea who we were. Jerry, you know, you guys know, I mean, you can cover your whole body with a, you know, an outfit and a mask, and short of watching a guy work and knowing his style, you're not going to know who he is a lot of the time, you know, unless he's got a tattoo or some distinctive marking. And yeah, I thought Hess was going to drop the microphone.
That's
he
funny
was shocked.
That you mentioned that, because they reran that angle in 72, 73, whatever it was, with Jerry Lawler and Tim White. And they were having a program with Dennis and Ken Lucas. And they did the whole thing, you know, they wouldn't defend against Lucas and Hall because they wrestled so many times, so they brought Lucas and, I don't know if Dennis ever told you this story, but they brought them in as the Avengers. And of course, Ken's got a tattoo. So they drew a tattoo on Dennis to try to match it. And of course, in the middle of matching, his tattoo's running down his arm.
Oh, my God. That's crazy. That's crazy.
Well, I know you were involved heavily with TV there in Knoxville, so I guess the two most famous angles of Fuller's Southeastern is Garvin throwing the belt off the bridge and Archie hitting Joe LeDuc with the sledgehammer with the concrete block.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, they put LeDuc in the hospital. I mean, that was legit. That wasn't work.
Yes.
Well, see, the point, you know, I don't know, you know, the deal with that And I've never had taken a sledgehammer over my head with a concrete block. But the whole deal, as I understand it, is you don't scrunch your neck down into your shoulders because you leave your head up and relaxed, because that way what impact that that sledgehammer does give, you've got some cushion for your neck to give, right?
Right.
And LeDuc, of course, had that big, short, thick neck anyway. And Archie, you know, because I remember hearing Archie tell, you know, and George tell him, you know, how to go through this. And they set it up. Archie lowered the boom of that sledgehammer. The concrete block broke, and LeDuc just pitched over to his side. And I'm waiting for him to budge, and he's not. And we're taping, right? I mean, they had to haul him out of there, and we had to get, you know. I've got a picture in my collection somewhere, somebody taking a me. I got up there with a damn push broom cleaning, you know, all those concrete fragments out while they were hauling him out so we could get back. Because we ran so tight on our taping. We were on the air two to three. There were sometimes Bill Kincaid, who was our director and who was a hell of a guy. I mean, he was a great, great guy to work with. There were times that he would do editing and stuff, and he wouldn't finish editing till like 5 minutes of two or something, right? And just in time to get the damn tape to the guy, you know, that ran the machines in the back. But, yeah, that was – and they put – Lou spent a couple of days in hospital. Ron thought he was working, right? Well, Ron just didn't want to spend the money. That's a Welch Fuller trade anyway, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But the doctor said, no, he's not working. Well, the doctor didn't use the word working. You know, it worked. Honestly, the angle worked out stronger because we went in to the hospital and filmed, you know, did a promo with LeDuc in the hospital.
Right.
So it turned out pretty good.
How long did Knoxville do good up there, Les?
How long was it good?
Yeah.
From you know, it kicked off pretty good in '74, and then when Poffo's gang came in and killed the territory, that was in '79. It would have been good past there. You know, I mean, we were doing great business. Well, you know, that TV, when we switched down to Channel 10. WBIR. It was CBS. I think they've changed affiliation, but anyway, they were the CBS affiliate at the time. I can't remember his name. Really nice guy. Was the sales manager at BIR. You know, a lot of stations that I've been worked with, the salespeople never get behind wrestling, right? Or don't care. They're like they're embarrassed or something. But anyway, he was really, you know, he wanted to make it work and make money off of it. And when we first started there, he was selling spots, 30-second spots for $50 on our show. That was, we first went on the air in there in 75. By 77, there was a waiting list to buy time on our show. And this is a sales manager telling me this. He had two national accounts. One was Dodge Trucks, I think. And those 30-second spots were selling for $250 a piece. That's how strong our show. And another yardstick is that, I forget what year it was, but UT, University of Tennessee, played Notre Dame for the first time like in 20 years or 15 or something. It'd been a while since the two teams had played football. But anyway, they played in South Bend. They played at Notre Dame. And Channel 26, the ABC affiliate, carried the game on that Saturday afternoon. And the best the UT Notre Dame football game could do against us was tie us in the ratings. And for us in Knoxville, Tennessee, that was a big win. I mean, to be able to, you know, especially a game as big as Notre Dame versus, you know, UT. So that's how strong our TV became. You know, we went in and we did the Jerry Lewis telethon. We did charity, the first charity softball game we did at the old Bill Myers Stadium. They were charged $1 a head for, I don't forget what charity it was for, but the wrestlers played the WBIR celebrities, like the the news people and, you know, the people who had talk shows and all that sort of stuff. And they brought a couple ringers in, obviously, because they, you know, probably didn't have enough. But anyway, we drew almost 2,000 people to watch a damn softball game at a buck ahead.
Do you think so, it hurt at all with him splitting it and coming to Mobile?
You know, yeah, it would have worked. It would have done well, I think. You know, if the deal in Knoxville hadn't, you know, if Papos hadn't come in Knoxville and killed that end of the territory, Ronald didn't have much fight in him. I'll be honest. You know, he wanted to get out of there, and he, you know, Mac and I and wanted to stay and go to war, but he wanted to sell out and get the hell out. So, you know, and it that's all it ever did. You know, you talk. I know there's, you know, and Jerry would probably tell you so. You, well, all three of you guys, there's been, well, like, look at the war in Atlanta. Everybody sold out, right?
Yeah.
Ann sold out on Tuesday night. We sold out on Friday night. She sold out on Tuesday night. We sold out on Friday night. But in Knoxville, it just fragmented the business, and it ended up just killing the territory, and it never survived. I mean, you know, Barnett bought it from Ron. Couldn't, you know, and brought in some good talent and never could get it off the ground. Then Crockett and Blackjack and Flair bought it from Barnett, and we had good talent in there for them. I came back. I'd gone down to Mobile, and Flair called me and said, WBR, you know, will leave us on their TV, but part of the deal is they'd like you to come back because they had a good relationship with you and you know, I was the go-between at TV. You know, if they had any problems with what we were doing, they'd talk to me, and then I'd go to Ronald and say, well, we need to change this and that. So anyway, I moved back up there to do their TV too. But still, it just never got off the ground, you know.
What were you going to ask, Jake? I'm sorry, I cut you off.
With me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm mad now. I'm not going to tell him.
He's covering up because he forgot already. That's
all right. No, I wasn't going to say anything.
Uh-oh,
so Flair and Mulligan didn't do nothing with it, huh?
No. Well, you know, part of it was, the crazy thing was, Jimmy was supposed to give us Roanoke, right, to go along with what we had in Knoxville already. And then between the Roanoke TV bleeding over into the Knoxville TV, we'd have covered that whole area and could have opened some more towns between Roanoke and Knoxville. But that never transpired. Flair was one of the owners, and I think he worked there once the whole time that, you know, we had the territory. And it just, I will tell you a funny story. Funny to me. You know, when Paphos came in there, Roop, and, you know, they were challenging, right? Of course, they were challenging Ron and Robert. They weren't challenging Tony Charles or Dick Slater or anybody like that. It was called subjective challenging, right? So anyway, a guy named Ed Hammond had a car wash over on Broadway, but he also worked security for us, right, and helped out doing this and that. He'd done that with Kazan, and he did it with Ron, did it with Barnett. So anyway, we were sitting in the dressing room one Friday night, right after, wasn't long after Blackjack and him had taken over the territory, and it was Blackjack and me and, I don't know, maybe two other guys. It was early. And so anyway, Ed Hammond came into the dressing room, and he said, hey, Blackjack, he said, Garvin and Roop stopped by the car wash early in the week. And Blackjack said, yeah, how about that? And he said, yeah. He said, they said, well, since we got new owners now, I guess we need to start our challenges all over again. And Blackjack said, Ed, tell those boys not to waste their TV time with challenges. Say, I've got my whole life invested in this territory. Just tell me where to be and when, and I'll show up. That was the end of the challenge. He was, well, they knew Jack wasn't going to get down on his fours, right?
Yeah. But it may all start up again next weekend.
Huh?
I said it may all start up again next weekend because let me read off who's supposed to be at the.
Well, I heard the Fullers are coming, right?
Yes.
Well, and until they show up, I won't believe that.
Well, I've been the same way. But here's since we're getting down to about 5 minutes left, I do want to plug this since we will not be on the air for the next 2 weeks. Next Saturday, a week from this coming Saturday, Saturday, March 2nd, the Theodore High School gym in Theodore, Alabama. The address is 6201 Sweettown Road North. If you are within any driving distance, a day's driving distance, come to this show. Doors open at 4 o'clock, bell time is at 5:30. So I guess we get it over when people go to the casinos at night. But here's
my God, we've got to leave the racetrack and run straight over there, then, don't we?
Well, we've had to cut it. They're doing trial practices that afternoon at the racetrack, so we've told them we'd be out of there by 2:30.
How far is it from the track?
15-20 minutes. It's close to the Red Roof Inn. Theodore, the Tillman's Corner is basically Theodore.
Well, good, because we got to go back. The guy in California I work for, Bill, David, is coming, and we're going to cut a promo with Steve Anthony before.
Okay.
I'll tell you the best match on that show, and I don't even know what the whole card is. It's going to be John Saxon against Steve Anthony.
Okay. We've got that. Robert Gibson is teaming with Bo James and Misty James. Not sure who their opponents are yet. I don't know what the cards are. There's going to be three live matches. Chip Day, Corey Hollis, Jailhouse Rocker, which is our friend Terry Lawler, are all going to be there. But this is the lineup as far as the legends go. Ronnie Garvin, Danny Hodge, Cowboy Bob Kelly, Percy Pringle III, the original interns, not Jim Starr and Billy Garrett, but the ones ahead of them. Dr. Jerry Graham's interns are going to be there. Ricky Fields, the original Dirty Daltons, who you know very well, Les.
Yes.
Jack and Jim Dalton, our esteemed colleague here with us, Les Thatcher. The sensational Intelligent Destroyer, Dennis Hall, Ron and Robert Fuller, Mr. Olympia, Marcel Pringle, Susan Green, Judy Martin, Joyce Grable, Porkchop Cash, the Wolfman Jason Sanderson, Bob Orton Jr., Tommy Gilbert, Tiger Conway Jr., Charlie Smith, Bobby Simmons, Tom Drake, Pat and Randy Rose, Duke Myers, Don Bass, Jerry and Nick Kozak, Terry Latham, did I say Ricky Fields earlier? Ricky Fields, Ray Hall, Scrappy McGowan, Matt McMurray, the original Big Blue Yankee, Bob Boyer, Roberto Soto, Bill White, Mickey Doyle, the Wrestling Pro, Sweet Daddy Banks, Ken Lucas, and more. So if you are anywhere, as I said, in driving distance, if it's an 8-hour drive for you, show up. The tickets are $25 ringside, general admission $15, students $10, and Lester don't bring your student ID card. You're getting in free, so you don't have to worry about that.
why aren't the Oates brothers going to be there?
Well, the hang glider. We've only got it up to
100. He couldn't book the hang glider that weekend.
Our workout partner's got a hang glider. We got to get it up to 180,000 feet, and I'm going to glide right in.
You got a hang glider? You serious? You have a hang glider?
Well, my workout partner's got one.
Really?
Yeah, he's got a glider, yeah. Another
one. You don't ride it, do you?
No.
Okay.
The other one's got a plane, blank buying the fuel for it.
Yeah, that. But you know, how late is this thing going to run, Mike? I mean,
clue.
And then they got 20 race drivers coming too, right?
Yeah, we've got race drivers. We're also inducting into the first class of the Gulf Coast Wrestling and Racing Hall of Fame. All three Fields brothers, Preston Hall, Buddy Fuller, and Lester Welch. Plus, I don't know the race drivers, but there will be race drivers. Inducted as well.
You mean Bob Kelly's not going to be inducted into this Hall of Fame?
This is his deal, so I'm sure at some point he will be, yes.
This sounds like a New York deal. You're inducting race car drivers into the Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Well, see, it's because it's Lee Hill on the racetrack out there, plus he was a wrestling promoter.
That's why
it's a combination.
Yeah, well.
That's why it's a combination. Well, hey, at least we're not putting him, you know, what's her name? What was the TV announcer there that did he work for you, Jerry Jones? Well, Rhubarb Jones. At least we're not putting him in there.
Oh, heck no.
Who? Rhubarb Jones.
Oh, you know what? A guy named Dave Dave Dreesen, who
Dave
out Dreesen, of Detroit.
Dave Dreesen, yes.
Yeah. Did yes, you? Used, well, yeah, Mike, you got that video, right? From Atlanta? From the 73 convention?
Yeah. The WFIA convention, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
This, and it's not because you're our guest tonight, but you were the best-looking thing on that video, I have to say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'll buy you a Coke or a beer or something in Mobile. I'll see that you're taken care of, kid.
I don't know who had the better hair, do you or Doug Gilbert?
Well, we had some hair, though, didn't we? Everybody had hair.
I bet there
Dromo looked young, and Bobby Orton. Nobody. It's funny. Nobody recognized Junior. I don't think. I mean, of the people that was sent to, I don't know anybody. A couple people, I guess, came up with his name. And
I ID'd him as Johnny Powers because he had Johnny Powers hairdo at the time. So I looked at it again and it was Orton Jr. But I ID'd him as
I'm having a
Johnny
senior
Powers.
Moment and I recognize what's his name from Amarillo, Dennis.
Dennis Stamp.
Dennis Stamp. Yeah.
Yeah. Dennis Stamp was there too.
Yeah. I ID'd him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there and I thought, damn, that's what I couldn't think of his name. Yesterday when I was looking at that thing. Now, the Kansas City thing, that was so dark. I recognized Bob Brown and the two twin old ladies that used to sit ringside every week in Kansas.
Murdy and Gertie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I used to date them.
Did you? Yeah, cool. Well, you know, I didn't want to say anything, but I thought they were kind of your type, but I didn't know.
It's just a good thing Roberto Soto wasn't in that territory. He'd have stolen him from
him. Or Charlie Smith. I have no doubt. Well, we kept him out of there.
Yeah, well,
guys,
there you
we
go.
We are out of time. Les, I appreciate you giving us your time this evening. I know you miss being on the radio every week, so that's
well. Yeah, I hate Rich. I used to build my life around Rich, and I don't get to do that anymore. But you know what? I always enjoy kicking things around with you guys, and I'd love to see my friend Jerry Oates again sometime if he ever gets his ass off the beach and shows up at a wrestling function again.
Well, you know, he's every time he's gone, that's when the great whites swim up to Savannah. He keeps those off the beach. That's
well,
the coyotes.
Bobby,
yes.
you'll have to sing for him there on the show if he's not coming to Mobile.
We'll hum a few bars or something, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
But we will not
before
be
we get
the
off there, let me mention again, you guys, too, check out WrestlingCares.com, and you'll see what my new project I'm involved in. And anyway, but I enjoy being on with you guys. We'll do it again sometime. And I'll see the two of the three of you in Mobile next week.
Sounds good.
Will.
All right, Jerry, tell the wife I said hey, okay?
I promise.
Love you guys.
See you, Les.
All right.
Take care.
Take care, Les. But as I was saying, we will not be on the air next week because of the Gulf Coast reunion. The following Thursday, I will be traveling. I'm hitting the road again. But on March the 14th, signed, sealed, and delivered, we will be joined by Jay West, who was the ring announcer for Georgia Championship Wrestling for many years, the television program, and he did the house shows in the city auditorium.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to having Jay on with us.
Be a good show.
So, guys.
Quick plug for our buddy Bo before we get out of here.
All right, yeah,
Sunday's the last day to pre-order his new book. I think it's $20, $25, but if you pre-order by Sunday, you get a free DVD with the book, and it's due out in the next couple of weeks, I think. KingofKingsport.com or something like that, just Google Bo James and you'll get it, and you got till Sunday to get the free DVD. I think it's going to be good. If you didn't read his first one, if this one's anything like the first one, it'll be well worth it.
Yes, it will. Jerry, you got anything to plug before we get out of here?
And I'm done, guys. Nobody wants to hear from me.
Oh, come on now. Don't you have a snow cone, something set up on the beach down there yet, or is it still too early in the season?
I'm permit for it now.
Hey, Flash Monroe never had a permit, so you know.
Yeah, he wasn't trying to sell on Tybee either. I guarantee he'd had a permit.
All right, well, Jerry, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Well, I'll talk
all
to
right,
you
guys.
In a week now, man. But
y'all have fun.
All right, take care, guys, and we'll see everybody in a couple of weeks.
All right, good night, guys.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.